Studies at Marine Corps University presents Israel's Response to Regional Missile and Rocket Threats, presented by Uzi Rubin, Rubicon Limited. Uzi Rubin founded and was the first director of the Israel Missile Defense Organization in the Israel Ministry of Defense, in which capacity he launched and managed the nationwide effort to develop, produce, and deploy Israel's Arrow missile defense system. In this capacity, he led the Arrow program from its inception in 1991 to the first delivery of Operation Missiles in 1999. He received his ME in Aeronautical Engineering in 1969 and subsequently directed several missile programs in Israel Aerospace Industries and the Israel MOD. In 1990, he was a visiting scholar in the Stanford Center for International Security and Arms Control, where he co-directed a major study on missile proliferation. Between 1999 and 2001, he was the Senior Director for Proliferation and Technology in the Israel National Security Council. He is a twice winner of the Israel Defense Prize in 1996 and 2003. In 2000, he won the MDA David Israel Prize for Achievements in Missile Defense. Rubin retired from Israel's MOD at the end of 2002, and has since been heading his own defense consultancy, Rubicon Limited, providing consulting services in military technology to the Israel MOD and Israel's leading defense contractors. He published frequently in the professional and international media on space and missile defense topics. This lecture took place 16 August 2012 at Marine Corps Base, Quantico, Virginia, Marine Corps University.
Of lectures that the Marine Corps University through the Middle East Studies conducts. Last year we did a series of seven lectures on the Arab Spring covering six countries within the Arab world and one Turkey, which was related, not part of the spring, but affected by or the countries that in the Arab world looking at Turkey for either leadership or models. And in this series, like this year, we have two sections. One is on Iran, coming up next month, and then next year we have one on Turkey. These will be actually three lectures together covering different aspects of those two countries I just mentioned. For all of these, and then we have occasional talks, such as what you will hear today, when we are fortunate enough to get people who are experts on the field that we like and happen to be here. Or we can arrange with them. But if you are not on our mailing list, or you're not receiving what we have, if you are already on there, you will receive it. You don't have to do anything. If you're not on it, please see Mr. Adam Sykes right there in the lift. He will put you on the mailing list. When you don't want to be on the mailing list, just simply say you don't want to be, and you won't be swamped by any emails. That I can promise you. Also, most of, not all, but most of our lectures will come up either in DVDs, audio, which will be posted on our website. Again, if you want a physical DVD of those, again, ask Adam and he will send it to you. There's no charge for any of these issues. And also we publish some of the issues. If you're receiving our material, we have a bi-monthly newsletter, and then we have occasional papers and monograph series. They will cover either things that have been done here, like lecture series, or we solicit outside or within our own staff and faculty. They will write items of related. Our area of responsibility in Middle East studies is kind of fluctuating, but more or less it starts in the east in Pakistan and ends on Egypt. That nice little arc there. With that, today we are very, very fortunate to have someone I know for a while, a friend. Indeed, we just met in Israel 2 months ago. I was giving a small talk and he was there and we talked about it, and Mr. Rubin said that he's going to be in the United States, and we talked about some of the topics. He gave me three topics. We discussed it amongst ourselves, and all three were so important that we asked him if he can combine all of them and talk about Israel's responses to regional missile and rocket threats. He was talking about the Hezbollah aspect, the Iranian and the Syrian. I thought, given what's going on in that part of the world today, We would like to hear all three of them. And so what he'll do is, he has an extensive lecture for you, and then I think the Q&A will actually open it up to all those topics or whatever else he would agree with you. Very briefly on Mr. Rubin's background, he founded and was the first director of Israel's Missile Defense Organization at the Israeli MOD, Ministry of Defense. And in that capacity in Israel, those of you who travel there, he is known, I don't know if you like that title or not, as the father of the arrow system. He started the arrow missile defense from its inception and basically left it at an operational stage in 1999, correct? He is the recipient of Israel Defense Prize, not once but twice, in 1996 and 2003. And in 2000, he won the MDA David Israel Prize for Achievement in Missile Defense. And most of the people we get here, just by nature, are mostly from my background, which is more political science academic. Today we are very fortunate to have somebody who has his hands on the actual technological aspect of what we do. And with that, Uzi, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Amin. It's really a privilege, and I thank you for the invitation to speak here. I'm quite excited. Though this place is world famous, and just driving this morning to the gate, I felt kind of a tingle of excitement. Quantico can go home and say, I've been here. So this presentation is really a challenge, and it's a double challenge. First, it's a challenge because I try to package three subjects, each one of them worthy of the whole seminar, into about 45 minutes, I think. Hopefully not more than 45 seconds. But the real challenge is that I'm not running my own show, and I'm relying on the good services of you people here. Hopefully, the mechanics won't stop us. But let me tell you that we technical people, and I'm a technical, we do magic. We invent weapons in CIA and do really amazing things. So one thing beats us is the mechanics of making a show. It's always. And I can start with an update that I told you before, that when I was doing one of the other program, at that time we didn't have much computers, and they didn't have CDs. We had VHSs. You remember those VHSs with a cassette? And after each test, I had to go to Armin. It's like Armin was the Prime Minister of the Ministry of Defense, with the video cassette and show it that it worked. But from test to test, his staff would change the VHS. He would give him the latest model. So every time I came there, we didn't know which button to push. And to make it nice, his staff put the VHS down in the lower bottom. So I found myself one day crawling on the floor with Yitzhak Rabin and our parts, excuse me, in the air, both of us trying to push buttons unsuccessfully. We didn't make it work. That day, we didn't see the video. He forgave me. So we're in a situation like that. Similar to that, hopefully it will work better this time. Let me start with this. If you ask an Israeli in general, especially from the ground forces, what's the main military threat on Israel, he will probably go into counting how many tanks all our enemies have and how many aircraft. If you ask a man in the street, what's the threat on Israel, he will tell you the missiles and the rockets of, that are around the world. So this is felt in Israel that we have we passed a watershed point. We were threatened once, 20 or 30 years ago. Our main threat came from regular military forces with high intensity warfare. Today, the main security threat to Israel is an indirect fire coming from governments or organizations and non-government organizations covering every point in Israel. This is a real threat. And the conventional threat, the conventional warfare was kind of receded into the background. Now, with everything is happening in the Middle East, I'm not sure the situation is going to remain this way. You may see the conventional threat coming back. But let's hope that it doesn't happen. I'm not going to cover that. What I'm going to cover is the main threat to Israel, as I see today, is most Israeli see, the missile and rocket threat. But I want to start first with the logic of the whole thing. There is a logic and there is a doctrine behind this massive army of our enemies with the missiles and rockets, and I will start with that, and then I'll go and describe the missile threat itself in some detail. I will be myself I'll be saying on the technical side there will be a lot of equations and formulas, and at the end of the presentation I will give you quizzes and you'll have to fill them up, and anyone who fails will have to sit for a few performance. But I decided what to do today. And finally, I'll talk at length about Israel's active defense system. And let me stress that all the material you're going to see is open source material. This presentation is on the record. The material is open literature, but the opinions are mine, my interpretation, and not necessarily the government of Israel. In several points, given I'm very critical of the government in Israel, and you'll hear. So, without further ado, let me now start struggling with this mechanical thing. Will it work? Why doesn't it work now? Okay. Now, this presentation was prepared a while ago, and this thing, the Arab Spring, what's called the Arab Spring, the appeal was still not the driving force in the Middle East. The driving force at that time was the ascent of Iran as a regional power. And I come to the Iran, the radical alignment of Iran was Iran itself, Syria, it's now in doubt, but Syria, Hezbollah is part of the Iranian force structure, and in the Gaza Strip, Hamas, even that changed a bit because the Hamas is not as dominant as it used to be before. But that was the radical alignment, and that radical alignment developed a new doctrine of warfare, for which I am grateful for the elucidation of that to Brigadier General Ittai Bruin. The General Staff today is the Deputy Chief of Intelligence Israel Defense Force, a very bright guy, and he made several presentations, some of them non-public and some in public, on the thinking of Hezbollah. The way they see the war against Israel, that actually represents the whole radical alignment way of thinking. Except that Nasrallah is very eloquent. But you read the Iranian generals are saying the same thing. But he's saying it better. So we are using Nasrallah's war in order to explain the thought behind the new method of methodology, the doctrine war, which we call by various names, Ittai Bruin calls it hybrid war. Why civil war? Because it combines elements of irregular and regular war. And here is Nasrallah himself saying he devised new type of war that is unlike anything in the world. It's not exactly true. We find it in Mao, we find it in Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh. But there is a local color to this too. And this combines regular war and guerrilla. And there is an underlying assumption behind. The underlying is asymmetric war, but in the deepest meaning of social asymmetry, not just military asymmetry. There is asymmetry between the societies. The societies are divided into the weak society of the West. They see the Western culture as a weak culture. They see things that we see are important and valuable as invaluable. Too much freedom, too much sex, too much greed, and especially too much fear of death. They are a heroic society, which the main thing is that they embrace death, they are not fearful of dying. And that makes them, in their eyes, stronger than our society. So this is the basic example, say, deep asymmetry, deep societal asymmetry, which they feel could be leveraged in their favor. You see it in action with all these suicide bombers everywhere, sometimes killing their own people. Just in order to kill people instead of taking a gun like here and crazy guy and kill, you put on a vest with explosive, go to the market and kill 50 Afghans. God knows why. So the hybrid warfare is designed to leverage this asymmetry, make the weak, so to call, strong. Those instances that the world society, which is weak in means, in financial resources and in weapons, make it overcome the rich Western society. You can see here, if I mention, can you push, no, can you go backward please, and can you push this hyperlink? This is one example. The Hezbollah has a victory museum in the town of Bin Jubail in southern Lebanon. This is kind of the capital of southern Lebanon. It's a big village, really, not a city. And there is a victory museum there. And this is one of the exhibits in the museum. You can see the Israeli menorah being cut down by the slingshot of the Palestinian heroic Intifada guy. And here is a spider here, and he says in English, not very good English, Israel is weaker than spider's heart. It means spider web. This is cobweb theory. Israel is like a cobweb. It doesn't mean that, he says it aloud, Israel is militarily very strong. They have so many tanks, we don't have them. They have the aircraft, we don't have them. But his society is weak. It's a weak Western society. And funnily enough, they even put in Hebrew here the word halash, which means weak. Why in Hebrew? Maybe they are expecting Hebrew-speaking visitors again. I don't know. It's very strange. Can you go back, please? Push this, please. Okay. So, what are the elements? How to implement this, make it from theory to practice? There are several features. First is intimidation. Intimidate the other side by showing, bragging, showing your force time at the time, mainly showing your missiles. Show how you can hit the other society in its back, in its homeland. And the pictures, can you push this hyperlink? These are the famous pictures from Iran. They do those public shows, time after time, showing this mass launching of rockets and missiles. This is to impress us, to show how powerful they are, to impress actually the enemies also on the other side of the Gulf, because my friends from the Gulf are also scared by that. Here's Hezbollah doing the same thing. These are from YouTube. Hamas, you can find open Hamas or Hamas rockets or Palestinian rockets in YouTube. You'll find hundreds of those clips showing them firing rockets. And even the Islamic Jihad, which is the second important organization, even went into this mood and started showing launching of rockets, which is not his. By the way, this is a clip from Libya, but they show it as jihadi rocket. They just borrow it. So this is an example. Can you push this, please? Go back. So this is one element. The other element is, if you don't deter your enemy, you don't intimidate it, there is a war. The main method of the war is for attrition of the other side society. That means shoot rockets and missiles, cause damage and cause casualties, mainly casualties. Nasrallah, one of his most memorable quotations was during the Second Lebanon War in 2006, said, "I don't measure my achievement by the real estate, by the number of kilometers I defend. I measure my achievement by the number of Israeli killed." And for him, it doesn't seem immoral. This is the moral way. This is societal war. So it's society against society. Civilians are legitimate victims, as much as their own civilians are legitimate victims too. They see themselves after the 2009 Israeli foray into Gaza, the Hamas leaders, one of them, I remember the quote, saying that in public, saying, "In the blood of our women and children, we defend our liberty." That means it's part of the game. Civilians are part of the game. Thus, of course, there are wise enough to understand that our side is not going to stay still and let itself be bombarded to death, and we do everything like to create and to defend and to destroy that capability. So the survivability of the capability is very important. The survivability by concealment, by dispersion, by embedding among the civilian population. They are very conscious of the Western norms against harming vulnerable civilians. So they want to use that in order to deny us the capability of, deny us and you the capability of preempting by embedding that, the missiles. And they have the missiles now in private houses, actually in cellars under houses which are inhabited with whole families. And you want to get into that, you have to kill the whole family in order to get into the storage. And the other thing is by delegitimizing, if you do that, if you go on after the armed caches which are under the buildings inside the cellar, of course, you delegitimize yourself in the face of the world. You get a report, a Goldstone report about war crimes, and there are three different reports. They want you to perpetrate war crimes. And then the other part of it is to provoke the other side into a massive land attack, for which they are preparing very thoroughly. They are not investing in high-intensity platforms of mobile warfare. They are investing in anti-tank missiles, the best of the best, handheld anti-aircraft missiles, the best of the best, the latest models from Russia. In this they invest, because they want you and us to go into a ground, launch a grounded attack, and this deals will be the chance to cause casualties. Again, they don't mind how many kilometers they lose. What they mind is how many soldiers they kill. Because for them, it's part of weakening the other society. They think that we are, our society is so sensitive to the deaths of our soldiers that it will demoralize them. And finally, dominating the cognitive battlefield. They are very conscious of the cognitive battlefield. That's why all this psychological warfare in the YouTube that you can find. But this is one, here is the problem that they face. Since this is part of the philosophy of the Mukawama. Mukawama, by the way, is translated, mistranslated, they do it intentionally, they mistranslate it into resistance, or in French, resistance, in order to evoke in Western audiences the feeling that the emotion of the French resistance against the Nazis in the Second World War. But this is wrong. Mukawama is not resistance. Mukawama is something which has taken unending war until victory. It's persistence. War can take on generations after generations. If they don't mind if they lose here or they lose there, it's not important. The important thing is to keep on fighting. And if our generation don't achieve it, the next generation will achieve it. However, there is a problem with this. Usually human beings are not that tolerant to start to sacrifice for some third or fourth generation to see the end and win the war. So they have to brag to show that they are making the progress. So every action ends with their victory, no matter what. Always there is a victory parade. We won. Why we won is to say, if the last of us still standing and fighting, we won. So this is part of the community, which also aim to make the other side kind of unsure of himself. If you think that you won, the other side is making a victory parade, so you're not sure whether you really won. So this is part of psychological warfare, which is working sometimes against that. When we come to the end of the presentation, you'll see why. To implement this doctrine, the armed forces of all this coalition have foregone the modernizing of major platforms like aircraft and tanks. They are investing everything in, actually they are not investing in war maneuver anymore. They see the war as a attritional stages, situational attritional war. They want to, they have no wish to attack anymore, to take over the ground. They just wish to fire rockets and wait for the other side to counter. So you don't see classic mobile warfare weapons being purchased by them. They emphasize tender weapons, they invest everything in missiles and rockets and huge numbers of them. I have a quote here from General Baidat, you see Baidat in one of the conferences, entering a new era, he called it firepower wars, it's hybrid war, and it, the other general name, and then you move it forward, right? Okay. And you see, for example, the Syrian efforts. Syrian efforts, by the way, didn't show itself up, this is before the war in Syria. For decades, you couldn't see a picture of a Syrian aircraft, a military aircraft, except in the museum. All of a sudden, they started having air show, and this is the first air show they had in 2010. What you see is fairly ancient stuff. This Sukhoi 22 ground attack aircraft is a museum piece. They have MiG-29s, the last one they bought in 1992. The Sukhoi 24, which is equivalent more or less to the British Tornado. But it's very old, and the MiG-23, which is still there, and recently we already saw them fly against the missile jets of MiG-23. This particular one, by the way, is in California, in the museum of California, and this is the one that landed in Israel, part of the fact that we saw the aircraft to that museum, but they are still flying, so it's pretty ancient stuff. And if you look at Iran, In 2010, there was the largest flyover in the Tehran. I counted them, 220 aircraft. One half of them were bought within the Shah's time. They are still flying, look at that, they are still flying Tomcats, the only place in the world, still flying, even this year, still F4, where they are working on, and again, pretty obsolete Russian stuff, MiG-29s and Sukhoi 24, nothing more. Instead, they are investing in missiles and rockets again and again. They are investing everything in developing. They set up their own development and R&D capability, and they have respectable R&D capability today. With this, I am in controversy and in discussion with some analysts in the United States and civilian analysts in the United States who see it the more liberal kind that believe that Iranians don't have this capability. We believe they have the capability to develop their own missile. The strategy is Shahab 3, which was basically a node on. They brought the production line, the Turing from the North Koreans. Initially, the range was 1,300 kilometers, and then they extended the range by making the missile a little longer, but mainly by changing the structure from steel to aluminum. Now, we think that's nothing, this is a major engineering endeavor to do something like that, because the whole properties of the missile change, its stiffness, its bending modes, its outgangs, everything changes. You have to actually to redesign the whole control system of the missile for the center of gravity is in a different place. So this is a major achievement, and the range went up to about 2,000 kilometers. Now they change the name of the missile. We don't understand the names. They change the name from time to time, and so share the same name in the several systems. We can't figure that out. The most bizarre thing is to change the color of the missile. Some of them are desert yellow, and then we see a blue, sky blue one, and then we see a banana green one. I have no explanation for that, but we have other problems to think about. So this is one of the lines. Next slide, please. Then, in parallel to this, two different industries. There is an industry called SHIG, which is making the liquid propellant rockets, and another, they set up a solid propellant industry called SBIG. This is the acronym of that. S stands for Shahid Martyr, and the next letter is for his name. So it is Shahid something this, which starts with B, and Shahid others, which starts with H. I don't remember the name. This one with B makes the solid propellant rocket. This looks very much like the Shahab that you saw before, but this is misleading. They just kept the diameter, because we rocket people, we love, when we stick to a diameter, we have a rocket with a diameter, we love to stick to the diameter. Because if you change that, you have to change the whole ground equipment, the launcher. So if you have a diameter, and they showed 1.25 meters, in the next design, the solid propellant is completely different, they stuck the same diameter. So they produce the same, essentially the same launcher, and the same re-entry vehicle, but it's a completely different one. The previous one with Shahab is single-stage liquid, this is two-stage solid. This is a leap forward in technology of about 20 years. If the technology of the Shahab is about SCAR technology of the early 50s, this is equivalent to American technology of the early 60s, the mid-60s. They made several tests of that, the range jumped up. There are a lot of physical controversy, what is the range, the potential range of that. The minimizer of the more liberal kind believes it's about 2,200 kilometers. According to some independent calculation within the team in the United States, the range is somewhere between 2,500 to 2,600 kilometers, enough to cover Eastern Europe from Western Iraq. Let me say that this is the key to global range, not liquid propellant. Liquid propellant is dead air. Liquid propellant is good for space shuttle. This is the future, like the American Minutemen, like the Russian Topol M, which was the main, and now the naval, the Russian naval missiles, also solid propellant. This is the way to ICBMs. The note means that they have ICBMs. So if they have ICBMs, it will be based on this technology. Next slide. Okay, and they are also now starting to bury the missiles in silos. So it's not just the technology, it's also the deployment, the survivability. We see them paying until now, until about a year ago, we saw only mobile launcher as a means of survivability. Last year, they disclosed and showed and brought a television team to take a picture of a Shahab inside the silo. And once they took this picture and published it, since we know the distance between the wing tips, next slide please. Next slide please. You see that the distance here is much bigger than the diameter, it's about 2.3 meters, but see how much space is left here between the wing tips and the silo. That means this is designed for something bigger. There is a growth potential. And what is the bigger thing? Next slide please. Well, we go to North Korea, we saw this missile which is called BN-25 or whatever, it has different names. We don't know what the North Koreans call it. This is an elongated Soviet design, the early Soviet design, this is N-6, which was the Soviet collapse. During the, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Russian company sold the design to the North Koreans and elongated the missile from that and put it on a mobile launcher. And the range is probably now 2,500 kilometers because it makes the only sense for this missile from North Korea as to hit Guam. Otherwise, it has no target. To hit Tokyo, they don't need one, they have no domes. And to hit Seoul, they don't need that, they have the SCARs. Actually, they don't need the SCARs, the rockets will do that too. So the only sense it makes is about 2,500 kilometers. Next slide, please. Is it in Iran? There's a great controversy whether the Iranians have it. We say they have it, our intelligence says we did it publicly, our government say it, but here in the United States and Europe, there are many who say that this is not true, they don't have it, this is a fable. Well, we don't have a direct evidence that the Iranians have it, but if you look at the part, this is part of the original Russian missile. Here is a junked Russian missile, a junker in Russia, here is one of the motors, and we see exactly that motor, spitting image of that motor, displayed in Tehran in February 2010. So it's not a smoky gun, but it's a smoke. Very thick smoke. I think that the Iranian security made it back here. If I were in line, I wouldn't show. Anyway, I have no doubt that the missile is there, and if you look at the map of the Middle East, next slide please, all the range of the Shahab 3 is relative to Israel. You see the Shahab 3 in Tabriz, and it is right, it's the original missile, then the increase the range, cover 1,000 kilometers, they can deploy back away from Israel interdiction, all the way to the Dasht al-Kabir desert. With a Sajin, they can deploy all the way to the Pakistani border almost, to hit Israel, but the BN-25 doesn't make any sense. To hit Tel Aviv, you have to deploy it in India. So this maybe doesn't make sense, but in the next slide, yes, it makes sense, because if you deploy it in Tabriz, it can hit almost the British China. So perhaps this is the reason why they got into this missile, because otherwise we don't understand, they don't need it for Israel. But maybe they need it for Europe. Well, let's go back to the next slide. They are covering every base, every technology available, and they are going also to cruise missile. They stole very smartly KH-55 air launched strategic cruise missile from Ukraine in the beginning of the 90s. When those missiles were stranded in Ukraine after the fall of the Soviet Union, about 550 of those missiles remained in Ukraine together with the aircraft, the 2-16s. After a while, there was an agreement was made between Ukraine and Russia, and everything was returned, including the nuclear warheads, except the missiles themselves. The nuclear warheads were taken back by Russia because they finally decided not to be nuclear, so they gave the nuclear warheads to Russia. But the missiles themselves remained for about 10 years. There was a lot of give and take, and finally they signed a contract, and the missiles were resold to Russia. They were sent back to Russia to refurbish its conventional missiles, except about 20 of them, which were mysteriously disappeared on the way. And they disappeared, they are now in Iran, North Korea and China. But the numbers is very small, so it's not for use, it's in order to copy. And we have no doubt that we are going to see an Iranian strategic cruise missile, which will look more or less like this, because this is the original missile. Probably not exactly like this. Range already, we see some hints in the blogs, probably not as long as the original Russian missile with 3,500 kilometers, would be to perhaps 2,500 kilometers, enough to hit Israel and Europe. Next slide, please. Can you do the next slide? Now, as I say, they cover all territory and they are developing their own capability. So they have artillery rockets. This is kind of a frog based on an old Chinese design, 600 millimeters. This is unguided rocket. They call it Zizal 2. Zizal, all the names are also psychological warfare. Zizal is earthquake, as much as I understand. Zizal 2, because it's a smaller one, Zizal 1, it's not very accurate. Let's say that if the Hezbollah would fire it against Tel Aviv, it would have difficulty finding Tel Aviv. It's so inaccurate. However, they have the capability of what they did, a trick, you know, between the difference between MLRS and GMLRS, at the MLRS, which is not a very accurate weapon, statistical weapon, a squad warhead, a screwing, smaller warhead with a guidance section and GPS, and all of a sudden, they have really a ballistic missile with accuracy of 5 meters. And some of the YouTube clips of what the GMLRS and GMLRS did in Iraq is unbelievable. I remember one of the clips of 3 rounds fired at the insurgent house, and the first one hitting this house on the top in the center, exploding, and then the second one coming exploding in the middle of the first explosion, the third one exploding in the middle of the second explosion. Unbelievable. So I think the accuracy is even better than 5 meters. Well, they did the same thing, and with this 600mm rocket, here you see the winglets, it's a guidance section here, they did it on their own. They managed to buy the equipment, they managed to buy the electronics, and they did it on their own, and now it has an accuracy from several kilometers down to maybe 300 meters. So it's not a strategic weapon. It can hit across the Persian Gulf, it can hit, select and hit power stations, for instance. And they are saying, the Minister of Defense, once said it, said, no mistake, if Iran is attacked, they'll attack the Gulf states and they'll take out the power stations, the airfields. He was very specific on the list of targets. They'll do it with this. Now they did one further, they made a further model of that, and they added a homing sensor to the top of that missile. Now it can home on moving ships, like the Chinese did with the DF-21D. So it's anti-ship. This is anti-ship ballistic missile, Iranian one, in service. And they test it from time to time. I don't know how much successfully, but it's durable. And since it's durable, one day it will work. And when it works, next slide, please. Next slide. Can you go to the next slide, please? Yeah. If you think about the implication, this is not a regular anti-ship missile, which is a C-skinner. This is a plunging weapon. It's coming from above. At a very high speed. The speed, the closing speed will be more than 1,000 meters per second. More than 3 miles. All this area is within the range of this kind of weapon. So you maybe will have to do something about it. Next slide, please. I want to go, I covered Iran very briefly, I could go on for hours on that. I want to go from there to the rest of this Iranian alignment. But in order to do that, I cannot ignore the latest development in the Middle East. My next target is Syria. I want to discuss the Syrian program to you. Syrian program was the most confidential program in the world, more confidential, more secret than the North Korean program. Nobody knew anything about it, but that changed. And in order to lead you to that change, I need to go to the people in the Middle East, actually in the Arab world, not the whole Middle East, because Iran, unfortunately, is not up in upheaval. Turkey is as stable as you can, and Israel is stable, but the Arab world, which I colored here, more or less in upheaval. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. No. Now, this is a very, in this small area, which is about as large as the eastern and the mid-eastern United States, plus the Great Plains, it's heavily armed and has all about 7 missile programs, 4 nuclear programs, 2 chemical programs. Unbelievable in such a small area how much unconventional weapon programs that you have from Iran, Syria, Egypt, Libya, and so on. Next slide, please. But during the time, some of those programs were taken out. The chemical, the Libyan chemical and nuclear programs were voluntarily given up by Gaddafi. And the Iraqi programs, all 3 of them were cancelled by force of American arms. And the Syrian nuclear program was also taken out by the force of arms of Israel, so they say in the papers. Never admitted by Israel. So, next slide, please. When the turmoil started, it covered 6 countries: Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, and Syria. of which about four of them have missile programs. Next slide, please. The process have reached, the stage of regime change in three of those countries, more or less successfully, surprisingly, relatively peacefully. But in Yemen, it's still simmering. In Bahrain, my friend in Bahrain are telling me that it's still unsettled, although we don't hear much about it in the paper. In Syria, we all know it descended into a civil war. And Syria with quite an extensive missile and chemical program. Next slide, please. So the unrest actually exposed two of the programs that were not known before. The Libyan program was exposed by this war. Gaddafi had those scars and they had the rockets. The warehouse were looted and the equipment is now in Gaza, in Somalia and in Mali. Mali helped the Islamic jihadists set up the Republic of the Moral and Muslims Republic in Djibouti, which is now killing women for fornicating and all the usual things. So I won't talk much about that, I'll talk about the Syrian program. So the Syrian program, all of a sudden, it was exposed. Let me talk about the origin of the Syrian program. Next slide. One of the Syrian program, missile program, was in the defeat of the Syrian Air Force and ground-based air defense in 1982, the first Lebanon war, where Hafez Assad Syrian, the father of the present Assad, and military forces were soundly beaten. He was a team of the Soviet Union, he had the Soviet aircraft, Soviet fighters, Soviet missile defense, air defense system. They were thrashed by the US-equipped Israel Air Force and Ground Force. Really crashed. But at that time, it was not enough. At that time, much people don't remember that, the Iran-Iraq war was also being fought out by, on one side, the Soviet-equipped Air Force, Iraqi Air Force, Saddam Air Force, and on the other side, an American-equipped Air Force, although there was an Islamic Republic, but they were still using all this huge amount of equipment and sharp bow. They had 75 F-14, actually no Soviet weapons, only American and American-trained pilots. And the result was the same. In the first few years of the war, the Iranian Air Force was beating the hell out of the Iraqi Air Force. So you could see very clearly that the superiority of Western technology, actually, it changed only when Saddam started buying French equipment. When the Mirage started coming with more than Western equipment, they started having the upper end in the until the end, the Iranians were running circular. People don't remember that the Iraqi nuclear reactor that was destroyed by Israel was first attacked by the Iran, not by the Israelis, with the force. So, Hafez Assad, not a stupid man, to make a conclusion from that. Of course, he didn't give up the fight, but he realized that with his Soviet equipped air force, he never made the war, as long as the Soviet are behind. So he decided to make two very strategic important decisions. First is to go from air power to missile power. Perhaps the first one in the world who conceived this idea. Because in the distances, in America it's very hard to think this way, because if you have to attack a country across the world, you cannot do it with conventional missiles. All you can do today, you couldn't do it at that time. And anyway, it's not cost effective. But in our part of the world, which is quite small, you can hit Tel Aviv with a missile as well as in the same price as you can hit it with a bomb, with much less risk. So he decided to move from air power to missile power, and that's one decision. The other decision to go into strategic deterrence against Israel, develop non-conventional capabilities. And next slide, please. He implemented that. Next slide, please. First of all, launch orbit. He started immediately. In 1982, made a huge buy of SCAR base from the Soviet Union, and then when the Soviet Union disappeared from North Korea, and lately from Iran, now it has, in June 2006, Syria and Iran signed a contract, the agreement alliance, which includes a missile chapter, and actually the stockpile and the expertise of Iran is now open to Syria. In parallel, Hafez Assad established R&D capability in Syria. All this was under the radar, completely unknown, as I said, the most secretive program in the world. him probably established a chemical warfare industry, quite an extensive one, built up capability, has operational chemical warfare now available for his missiles, and he started a nuclear military program financed by the Iranians. As I said, it was either stopped or held back by this unattributed attack in 2007. But the policy was total opacity. That was secretive. Syria never admitted publicly that it has missiles. You couldn't find a picture of an Iran and Syrian missile in any paper, in any way. In only in two occasions they admitted they had missiles in the army, by the way, because they were testing the missile. And every time they tested the missile, it was in the papers. It was discovered. They can't hide it. When an Iraqi Syrian missile was fired, all the radars in the Middle East could see it, including the 6th Fleet, including the Israeli one, and they were important. But they never reacted to that except in two cases where the missile misbehaved, there was malfunction, and they fell on Turkish territory. Then they apologized to Turkey, which was a roundabout way of admitting that they had missiles that hit Turkish territory. So all this was secretive until now. And now all of a sudden, the situation changed. Why is that? Next slide, please. Next slide. Let's look at the war in Syria. Fighting is mainly along this axis between Jordan and Turkey, the ancient royal road from Jordan, Palestine to Turkey. That's the road that St. Paul went on his way to Damascus, and all the major cities are along there. That's where fighting is, although there's some fighting in Israel so too. And it's like the Spanish Civil War that comes to mind, a very similar situation where the local war is now being cashed in by outside forces. The Iranians are there, 43 Iranian officers were caught lately by the rebels, and the Iranians admitted that they were Iranian agents. There is a Hezbollah which is fighting actively on the side of Bashar's forces. The Russians are actively aiding them and sending equipment and giving them not just military but also political backing, to some extent the Chinese. In the background is hovering NATO. Everybody remember the intervention against Libya, which talks from time to time about intervention in Syria, and I think the Secretary of State lately raised this possibility again of no-fly zone. The Syrian regime goes into ban in the air district. This is the worst nightmare. An intervention, all remember Gaddafi. So in order to deter you from intervening, they decided to unveil your capabilities. Next slide, please. And they started doing Iranian-style fire shows across the board with all the power, very impressive show. The ground-based air defense had a fire exercise, anti-ship defense had an exercise, and ground-to-ground missile had an exercise. I will concentrate, of course, on this, because also this is a strategic arm. When you see those missiles, think about chemical warheads on top of them. They are not fitted on them now, but they are in the stores and they are ready to use. Let's see some of this. Can you hyperlink this one, please? This one. Let's see some of this show. They made two shows.
Four unguided and three guided. There was no supply. We knew about each of those types, but we never saw them before in Syrian colors. Some of them we didn't see at all, and some of them we didn't see in Syrian color. Now I'll give you the interpretation of what we saw. Next slide, please. Next slide. Here is a lineup of unguided rockets. Next slide, please. One of them is the ancient. This was supplied. We knew it existed. This is 47. This is really a legacy museum. This why they're still using it. They've got better stuff. I don't know. But what we can do? Besides, this demonstration was very powerful. And the trick that you saw was not just somebody who took it, put it in the system, put it in a website by inviting them to YouTube by the ceiling button. So for everyone to see, nobody will tell you. The 47 was there probably to make an impression. Next slide. Much more capable is this missile, which they call My Salute. My Salute, by the way, the names are also very evocative for Syrians. My Salute is a battle. The Syrians celebrated between the Syrians and the French, who were trying to occupy, actually occupy Syria after the First World War. And the Syrians organized a small army. The battle, there was the village east and west of Damascus. There was a short battle which the French, of course, won. The commander, the Syrian commander, was killed, and this statue now is in one of the main schools of Damascus. The Battle of Marcelon, very patriotic. You can see that this is the image of this example. So either locally made version or copy or maybe it's an example in the Syrian color. The larger of those is completely different, as you see. This is a Syrian design. Next slide. Al-Qaeda rocket, two types, 2,220 millimeters MLRS, which is only a Russian design, the rocket itself, not the launcher, which the Russian user called, they called it the system Uragan, used very successfully in the war in Georgia in 2008. And this one looked familiar, this kind of truss system, 302 millimeter, probably a licensed product produced Chinese missile called WS-1, Chinese rocket. But the launcher looked very familiar. Can you click the slide, please? We saw this launcher before. In the second Lebanon War, we saw this picture of a burned launcher, and you can see the same type of open structure. So it's probably this 302 millimeter, and we know for a fact that 302 millimeter rockets were fired in Israel. After one instance, the launcher was taken out. And can you hyperlink this? No. Go back and hyperlink this. This is the footage released by the Israeli Air Force in 2006. This one bombarded the town of Kedera. Was caught about a minute and a half after firing, and you can see it here. That's from the window. You see the shadow of the operators trying to prepare it for moving, but it didn't have time because it was taken out. We probably see the, go back please, go back to the slide. So this is probably that launcher that was taken out of that action. The picture is from Lebanon. Somebody in Lebanon took the picture of that and put it in the web. And here is now we see the launcher in a complete position. That's for me very amazing to see it in real life and in color. Next slide, please. The next one, the private place, belonged to the Syrian-made guided rocket. As I say, same thing like the GMLRS. Now this is Syrian designed and made, very similar to the Fakat 110, the Iranian Fakat 110, and actually the same launcher. It's not just a copy, it's the same launcher exactly. So it's either Iranian supply or a Syrian copy of the Iranian design. Range is about 300 kilometers, this is a beast, 300 kilometers, so it's like a Scud B. Warhead is slightly smaller than a Scud B, only half a ton, but believe me, half a ton on an airbase is going to do some damage. And the accuracy probably, as I said, like in the Fakat 110, CP of 300 meters, let's say, would be typical, on a range of 300 kilometers. Once you do this trick, you are not range dependent anymore, by the way. Accuracy remains the same whether you fly to 100 kilometers or 300 kilometers. It's something that drives itself all the way to the target. So this is really a great leap forward in technology. Next slide, please. Next slide. They showed the most advanced type that they showed was the SS-21, the Russian Tochka. This is a QSC, really QSC weapon from 120 kilometers, designed to take down air defense command centers and radars, with a accuracy of about 50 meters, and the bomb at warhead. They showed one only, on only one occasion, of two fire exercises they had, only in the first one they showed it, and they're very careful not to show the launcher.
because from the launcher you can see whether it is original Russian design that was used also in the Georgian War in 2008, or the North Korean emulation of that, which is called KM-02, that we see in Pavels in Pyongyang. Next slide. And they show the Scud, probably Scud C, the name, they call it, no, the C, the name, how they call it, Juran. Juran is Golan Heights, but it's Juran 2, not Juran 1. So, parallel to Shahab 1, Shahab 2, Shahab 2, Scud C. Shahab 1, Scud B, 300 km, Shahab 2, Scud C, 580 km. So, probably this is Scud C, supplied from North Korea and assembled in Syria. Next slide, please. And there are some cues in that show that people should pay attention to. The robot in Ukraine here, showing very carefully that they are aware that they are facing missile defense. And they are showing how they are going to break through by mass simultaneous synchronized launching. Notice this synchronized launch you saw before of the two Scuds. I measured it, I timed it. 0.6 seconds between the first and the second. Now just multiply it several times by 6 or 7, take six launches like that, and they hope it will break through missile defense system by saturation. The Iranians do the same. Presentation, show after show, they show simultaneous launching. By the way, the last one showed in July, it was a very rapid fire. They didn't manage to fire them simultaneously. Took about a minute and a half between the first and the second, but usually they do it much better. So you see they're emulating the Syrians. Next slide, please. They're emulating the Iranians. Next slide. Next slide. Can you move to the next slide? Same thing, here is a Syrian in the same fire show showing the two unguided rockets, 302 millimeters from two separate launchers. They found how to synchronize them. I couldn't measure the difference between the two arms. It was within less than a tenth of a second. Same thing, the Iranians here, so this famous shows of the five zigzag taking off in the same time. The idea I'm not saying is saturation of missile defense systems, both of ours and across the Gulf, the Gulf states are building up. Next slide, please. But this is not the only cue in that show. Notice this picture that we saw here. Notice the color of the vehicles. Those are civilian colors. What they're going to do, they know that in wartime they'll be hunted. So they're going to be, lose themselves among civilian traffic. They're going to mimic civilian trucks. The colors, look at those colors, but you see the same thing in Iran. It is actually, I don't know who collects the colors, only the same guy by the trash, because the same color, I believe it, there is. I saw in Iran this color too, but I think it was too lazy to find it. So this is another white one. But the same thing, they are going to hide the equipment, the civilian equipment, counting against the aversion and the aversion of the Western armies to hit uninvolved civilians. So there are two important cues. They are aware they are going to be hunted, they are aware that they have missile defense system, and they are showing it that they are going to solve the problem. Next slide, please. Next slide. Back, what I showed up to now was what the Syrian government is showing about its missile. But it's not only the Syrian government is showing a Syrian missile, it's also the opposition. And here's a picture of the opposition crew of overtaking Syrian missile base. This is actually anti-aircraft missile, not ground-to-ground missile. Same tools. And I don't have time to show you the whole clip, but it's amazing. They are inside the base, and you see the missiles abandoned. Actually, you see a truck, a transporter with a missile, and half-turn abandoned, with the door open, and everybody ran away. They took over the missile base for a while, and probably left it, abandoned it. But the next slide, please, next slide. This is even more amazing. Can you hyperlink this picture, please? This is the whole Scud. Probably what's enemy territory, because there's a guy from the opposition standing in the camera taking picture of this. What kind of Scud? Actually, it's all his logistics and anti-aircraft fire. I don't have time for anti-aircraft you can stop it now. Now notice that it's a convoy with live Scuds. Some of you see that in broad daylight. In broad daylight, in what could be enemy territory with the guy from the opposition, he could have an RPG instead of a camera. So this shows some kind of desperation. What stress the Syrian government is. And now when you come to think of it, what happens in Syria, I showed you all those missiles, I didn't show you any chemical wars because we have no pictures of them. The fate of Syria is, should be a concern, a proliferation concern to everyone. God knows what's going to happen to all this equipment. Who's going, what happened to the Libyan equipment, we know. The Libyan stuff is now all over the Middle East. What's going to happen here? And this is much more capable stuff. And with this, I leave Syria and go to the other players in the threat against Israel. Next slide, please. Next slide. Well, before I leave Syria, one more point. I pointed out that they made a very powerful show of sea defense system. All types of C-0802, this Chinese missile, with 70 kilometer range, it hit the Israeli Hanit in the Second Lebanon War. This is a Sikor, a modernized Sikor, taking off from a ship, missile boat. And the most important, the most capable is the Soviet Yakhont, a supersonic anti-ship missile that goes Mach 3, above the waves, very hard to hit. And they showed all three of them. This one even showed the launcher, to show that they can operate the launcher, and they are waiting for NATO navies with a range of about 300 kilometers. What does it mean? Next slide, please. It means first that they are having a keep away zone in the Mediterranean, which stretches west of Cyprus. And it affects, to some extent, the first phase of the European phase that of the approach missile defense program, which is now in place and operational. Here is where the threat is from Tabriz. Here is the expert radar in Turkey. And somewhere in the Mediterranean are the 80 ships. Now they have this keep-away zone, which is not decisive, it's not a showstopper. But the geometry is a little less optimal. But we can't go into this area. There is another problem here. If there is a war in Israel and we try to send 80 ships to assist Israel missile defense, it will be threatened by those Syrian missiles. Next slide, please. But this is one meaning of this thing. The other thing is this, is God in his wisdom has made the Middle East a very fascist place with a lot of wealth, but also gave it a lot of wealth. And this wealth is being discovered, more and more often being discovered lately, in the last few years, we discovered another bonanza in Eastern Mediterranean is now the source, with zillions of dollars worth of gas available there, already used by Egypt and already exploited by Israel. Now the extraction rights belong to all the liberal countries, Turkey, Syria, Cyprus, Lebanon, Reed, Hezbollah, Israel, Palestinian Authority, future Palestine perhaps, and Egypt, and just from this list of countries, you can imagine the wars that are going to happen here. So think about Turkey and Cyprus, think about Lebanon, Hezbollah, and Israel, and the calls have already started. So all this, to extract this, you need these oil rigs, which are as huge as stationary aircraft carriers, and I showed you all those missiles before. Those things are getting taken out easily with those missiles. Next slide, please. Next slide. Next slide, please. Okay, you can see the Syrians have the Yakhont, the Hezbollah has the C-1802. And even the Hamas, believe it or not, the Hamas in Gaza have anti-ship missiles now that can hit those stationary targets with no problem at all. So this is a war, another war waiting to happen. The Middle East has flashpoints, this is another flashpoint. And because of that, the Israeli Navy is now starting to buy into missile defense system. Next slide, please. We are developing now, not much the headlines, the Barak 8 system. Missile defense, another missile, our own embryonic Aegis. Right now, the capabilities against sea skimmers and aircraft, but eventually we will get some capabilities against plunging targets too. We have no other choice because we have to defend our resources. Israel is already using the gas from those fields for all our electricity, and with the new funds, it will guarantee Israel energy independence for about 50 years at least. So it's going to be very important for Israel and very valuable target for enemies to take out. And with that, this time we'll move to the other threats. Next slide, please. Talking about Hezbollah, not much. They have now SCUD that they got from Syria, and they got the Fatah 110. In the Second Lebanon War, those Zizat with the same range couldn't find Tel Aviv and they were fired. This time, Nasrallah made the same list like the Iranian minister, he made the same list in Israel. He said, if you attack our airport, we'll attack your airports. If you attack our power station where they could take out your post and show he has the capability to do it now with this missile. Next slide. And of course we have this picture very similar to what you saw before, because whatever the Syrians have, or the Hezbollah has, the next slide. Now they have the smaller stuff, the Katyusha, so I won't go into that, 107 millimeters, tens of thousands, 60,000, 70,000, the number by the way is meaningless. It takes a lot of time to fire 60,000. Just to give you an example, in the Second Lebanon War, they had a stockpile of about 14,000 rockets, and during the month of war, they fired 4,200. It's about one third. So it's really, it takes a lot of time to fire all those rockets, so the numbers are just impressive. And to have the fact that they cannot fire so many of them in the war, in the region of the war, let's say, if the war takes more than 1 month, then the problem of Israel is not the rockets. We much worse than that. Next time. And the range, of course, now Hezbollah has the means to cover all of Israel with those scars all the way down to the town of Eilat, the southernmost tip of Israel. Next. Now let's go to the interesting case of Gaza. This is really a case study of a war miniature between non-government organization and organized state by harassment of the organized state. You can write probably historical textbook of military history. We cite this case. Hamas started by making their own rockets in the beginning of the 2000s. The art of making your own rocket is in the internet. If you want to make your own rocket at home, you can do it. Open some amateurs who are making their own rockets and flying them. And the best thing is to make a propellant. Now, to make a propellant, you take in the kitchen. You take sugar, you melt it in a pot very slowly until it's syrupy, and then you take fertilizer that you buy from the store in the garden and mix it very carefully and cast it into some kind of a dye, and you get a propellant there. It's not a very good propellant, and if it fractures, it explodes instead of burning, and I don't advise you to do it at all, but it works. So with this they started making very short range rockets, 44, and then they extended the range all the way up to 12 or 16 kilometers after a lot of the military industry of the war. Smaller warheads in the beginning of about 5 kilograms and then went to about 10 kilograms, not very little, but it managed to kill people. Altogether it killed about 17 people in the Gaza government, and then they graduated to factory made drugs, well made drugs from the outside that smuggled through the tunnels, and then they graduated to an extended range Iranian version of the drug rocket. This is amazing. They took the 20 kilometer range of the BM-21 drug, 120 millimeters, the same rocket, the same shell. They poured, they took out the old propellant, put out more energetic propellant, and doubled the range to 43 kilometers. And now they have longer range stuff that can reach all the way to Tel Aviv. Next slide. Slide, please. Lately, last year in October, I was sharing an experience with you. I was reading a book in bed before going to sleep, and it was a rainy night, and all of a sudden I heard sirens. I thought that the ambulance, no, that sounded like public alerts alarms, and listening to that, from the south to the north, all around the country, all the way from the southern part of the country all the way to the north part, I heard an alarm sounding. I thought that I was making a mistake, and then I heard a few minutes later a rolling thunder. Well, I immediately went to the internet and started to turn it in here. The next morning, we found out that they fired a rocket into Israel, a long-range rocket. The alarms went all the way to the expected impact point of that rocket, which was very near the suburb of Tel Aviv, Rishon LeZion, but the rocket didn't reach there, it fell about halfway. It was a real rocket. And very long, it's not a glove, something much heavier than that, and the thunder that I had was the warhead of the rocket, which was about 50 kilograms, exploding not far away from our town. So they had the capability now of about 80 kilometers. Next slide, please. Next slide. Well, 3 days later, our reports took this picture of a truck. Well, I don't have the time to show you the slide, but four people coming out with a big rocket and taking this as a test range of the Islamic Jihad in southern Gaza Strip. It's an abandoned quarry, and four people carrying the rocket. Now, four people, that means it's a heavy rocket, because a grab can be taken on the shoulder of one man. four people are telling them, and they aligned it. Now here is the north. The UAV saw the line east-west, so they were either going to fire it into the sea or to Beersheba. So in order to not to have any confusion there, the UAV just killed this missile. With all its team, it turned out that the head of the team was a general of the Jihad, coming Jihad, and then went late and started firing going to Israel. And our missile defense system worked, the whole story. But anyway, now we know that we have those rockets that can hit them. Next. I showed you all the streets from Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, and I don't count other countries, missiles in the Middle East, Egypt, we still have peace with them, let's hope it keeps that way. Saudi Arabia have missiles, but we don't count them as a threat. But you look at the implication for them, the community threat, and this is a core area of Israel, and I ask my fellow Israelis who live in Eilat the forgiveness of not including them, but 90% of Israel population is in this area, and all the resources in this greater Tel Aviv area, all the economic assets are banks, and the military the headquarters. All this is threatened, next slide please, cumulatively, by about 13,000 warriors that can reach not all of them at each point. If you count how many can reach this anywhere in this area, there's some place in this area, about 1,300 warheads, of which about 1,500 can hit the greater Tel Aviv area. That was about a year ago, my calculation. That means Israel, no place is safe, and Israel's main assets can be taken out with now growing military profit. Next slide. This is a new reality. This is a new reality because they have now the capability to reach anywhere in Israel, cripple our key national assets, interfere with military operation. All our depots are in the areas of central Israel. All our tanks are stored there. All our anti-aircraft defenses are stored there. So here is again a quote from Yossi Bidax, General Bidax, saying in 2006, that was the U.S. 7-11 war, we were threatened by a few dozens of rockets that could reach central Israel. This is now turned into thousands of rockets, and quantity has turned into a quality. Next slide, please. Of course, it's military doctrine had to be rethought. And our legacy doctrine didn't take this into account. All our wars during the last 65 years, the real area, the homeland area, was safe. Fighting took place in the frontiers and beyond the frontiers, not within Israel. So the doctrine was changed. Up to now it was three pillars of deterrence, preemption and offensive. Now it's including the defensive too. And the defensive shield that is being set up has three tasks. It's first the preservation of Israel Defense Forces to fight. Now you don't face this problem because the United States is far away between two oceans. Its homeland is not threatened by conventional forces. That's not the situation in our case. Where the front is in the rear and the rear is in the front. So first thing, you have to preserve the IDF capability to fight war, because if that's included, we are in a bad situation. Second is to preserve key national assets. You cannot fight without power stations working. You can't even fuel military trucks without power stations working, because the fuel stations will not work without electricity. And of course, mitigate the casualties among the civilians. I say mitigate, not prevent. It's impossible to prevent, but to mitigate as much as possible. Next slide, please. Next slide. So the Israel missile defense in the making, still working progress, is the then ideas of a four-layer system, the upper tier and the intermediate tier, and the lower tier, and then bubbles of local defenses. Next, I'm now going to the details. Next slide. The aero system, which I had the privilege of leading, is now operational since the year 2000. You can see here the missile. This is a test, by the way, in Portland, in California. We test from time to time. The terrain is too small for our testing. We're going to longer and longer ranges, so tonight's a very generous way now to use the test range in the Pacific Ocean, where we have more realistic ranges. This is an interceptor launcher fire control system, unlike the U.S. Army system, which are very automated. We believe in controlled situations, and there is no interception in Israel that is not without a human controller controlling it. I mean, it doesn't have a joystick, but the authorization which is done by a human being, and there is a ball button which can be pushed, and the whole process can be stopped if we see that we are going to hit an aircraft, passenger aircraft, instead of a missile. Well, this is very congested skies that we have in the Middle East. While war is being fought, passenger aircraft keep flying to all the neighboring airfields. And here is our radar, the green time, so I can take the radar. We have a missile industrial partner, Boeing, which is, has manufactured part of this missile in the United States, and a very good partnership, because this is a joint program in the United States. It was jointly funded by Israel and the United States, about 50%. Next slide, please. This was supposed to be the upper leader, but with the advance of the threats and with the increasing ranges, we found that this is not sufficient, and we had to have a tier above that. And that tier is level 3. Now, let me share a secret with you of a program manager. Never call a new program by a new name. Always stick to the old name, just change the suffix. Why? Because if you put the new name, the bin counters, just think about the zillions of dollars you're going to spend. Oh God, new system, so many million dollars. If you call it by the previous name, it's just an adaption. You know, it was 02, same thing, 03. No, it's a new reason. So now you know the secret, I don't have to kill you because it's not that secret. 03 is a completely new missile with much more capability. We cannot go into the detail, but it's as advanced as anything that you have now on the radar and board. Very innovative design, which is fully patented. Again, there's an industrial partner going. In this case, it's not just a joint program, it's a shared program because part of the R&D is done in the United States by American engineers. And jointly funded, and in the pilot we upgraded the radar mount, almost doubled the range. Next slide, please. Next slide. We are also beefing up early warning capabilities, early warning attacking capabilities, very important, especially against saturation, what's called mass raids. When information is the main thing and you don't have much time, you have to discriminate very quickly between what's important, what's not important. So, the United States has positioned, this is US equipment, TPY-2 radar is now positioned and deployed in Israel, but it's US property, operated by US troops. We gave it a piece of real estate in the Negev. It's there, it's tied up in our system, it's taking part in our exercises, and it's unbelievably capable radar. I mean, I take my head off, I think our entire industry is great, but later on, are the masters. This is really a capable piece of equipment, but it's not enough. We are going to electro-optical warning system too, aboard UAVs, which is our program on the Israel Eitan UAV. Not going very quickly, tonight test should go quicker than that, but it's very important to see the world and the sky picture, what they call in two physical means in order to do discrimination. Radar and electro-optical, when the two you compare the two, you immediately see what's the chaff and what's the not chaff. Next slide, please. And one tier below is Stunner, or David's name. This is a missile which is designed against two different targets. Heavy rockets, which are not too short range for aero to intercept, and against cruise missiles. We see the cruise missile threat coming. As I said, we are going to face the Iranian strategic cruise missile. Now, a cruise missile is a sneaky animal. Unlike a ballistic missile, which is very hard to hit because it's fast, but it's very easy to see because it's flying high in the sky, a cruise missile is very easy to hit. If you know where it is, you can shoot it down with a 50 caliber machine gun because it goes slow, but you don't know where it is. It's sneaky. It goes inside the terrain masking. So you have to know where it is. We are developing an overhead capability to see it, like JLS. We have a similar program to see the cruise missile coming in. This is a picture of that missile, joint development, again, not just joint program, joint development with radar, which is a real contact developed in the United States. And you see the flyout status. This is approaching very soon. It's going to have a first interception test, its own dedicated radar, and its mobile launcher. Next slide, please. Next slide. Last but not least is Iron Dome, which is much in the news, rightly so. It's composed of a very small interceptor. This is a dedicated interceptor which looks and acts a bit like air-to-air missile. Basically, it's a derivative of Rafael's very capable larger air-to-air missile, but made smaller and fired from the ground. A very large launcher for massive firepower and specialized radar. Now, the little word here is combat proven. This is really combat proven. As of today, it already has shocked 1 in 5 kills, actual kills in battle. Now, to walk you through that, I'll go to the third part of my presentation, and this is the ongoing war between the rockets of the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad in Gaza and Israel's missile defense. This is a case study that we will be studying in the future in military academies, because we are not following any book, we are writing the book. This is history and the writing. To bring it to that, let's move back in history, next slide please, and talk about the rocket assault on Israel and south of Israel. Next slide, this is not important. Next slide. Here's the arena south of Israel. This is the Gaza Strip, here is Tel Aviv, and here is Jerusalem, which gives you the sense of this very constricted geography we are in. The distance between Gaza and the downtown Beersheba is like Dallas Airport to the capital. So actually it's like in a backyard. The whole fight is, in American terms, in European terms, it's in a backyard. Here are the major cities in the south, Ashdod, about the number of inhabitants, the census of 2011, and my hometown is where this zero is. Ashkelon, Sderot, smaller town, which is about 2 kilometers from the border, and Beersheba, which is a major industrial city, is a major, this is the second major port in Israel. Next slide, please. When the Hamas started harassing Israel with their homemade rockets, for a while it was just homemade rockets in the neighborhood, the immediate neighborhood of the Gaza Strip, and the major town that was hit here was Sderot, the knife became Heaven's Sderot. But in 2006, next slide please, the range was extended, they managed to reach Ashkelon in 2006, a major city now, and in 2009, next slide please, the range was increased again to 43 kilometers and the cities of Ashdod and Beersheba came into range. And people started getting hit inside those cities. There is another feature of this fire, it's unpredictable. Sometimes we expect them to start shooting because something is happening, like we take out one of the terrorists, so we know to expect a reaction. But sometimes it just happened by itself, we don't know why. And all of a sudden a barrage of rockets is fired into Israel out of the blue in the middle of the night. There is no rhyme or reason because, mainly, we don't understand why. There are also 4 different organizations in Gaza that own rockets. Basically anyone there in Gaza for a small amount of money can buy a rocket and fire into Israel. So things coming in burst, and there is no centralized command that you can use, centralized structure that you can talk to and convene. There are kind of a coalition of organizations. When they want a ceasefire, they have to consult and agree on the ceasefire. There's no one who gives a command to them. So it's very chaotic, the whole thing, and we have to cope with this chaotic situation. Next slide. Next slide. Quantity-wise, you can see the history of the number of rockets fired per year, starting in 2001, with few rockets, then growing up slowly. And in 2008, it came to a situation that became intolerable. 3,000 rockets in the same year, almost 3,000 rockets. Life became impossible around Gaza and further than Gaza, and the Israeli government decided to launch a major ground offensive into Gaza, which was quite successful. Our military went in, contrary to all the traditional disaster, it reached Gaza and actually was about 1 kilometer away from the main headquarters, and there was nothing to stop our troops just to go into the headquarters under the Shifa hospital, take out all the leaders of the Hamas and put a bullet in their head, or take them home. Very wisely, the Israeli government decided not to do it. We pulled back. We were vilified by the rest of the world by that. If you remember the picture, the number of 14,000 Palestinians killed, most of them by the way around Palestinians. But I don't deny the collateral damage. We assume that at least 1/3 of the dead were uninvolved civilians. So we paid dearly in political coin for that. Image, political, legitimate coin, but the inhabitants of Israel got a respite. and the number of rockets drastically went down, certainly the number, the ranges shrank back into harassment of the nearby area, mostly in open fields. So life became tolerable again until 2011, when they started blowing up. But this time, they made Israel missile defense. Because in the meanwhile, next slide please. Next slide. In the meanwhile, we went into missile defense. Why it took so much time? During all those years, 10-year history of this conflict in the south, the offensive measure that our military took was trying to interdict the missiles, to try to take out the production lines. It was unsuccessful. In the defensive measure, extensive civil defense, the alert, very effective. Even 15 seconds is enough. If you lie down, those rockets are not very lethal. You can be saved or you run into a building. So even 15 seconds alarm for further communities was more seconds than 15 up to a minute. It was very effective, but no active defense. Active defense was not pursued for many years because first our military gave it low priority. Our military is very aggressive and offensive minded, and it was quite reluctant to allow resources to go from offensive weapons to defensive weapons. Our treasury saw it as, you know, the cost effectiveness was didn't seem right. I mean, here you have to spend this money and send this interceptor, which costs tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of dollars, to get the rocket made in the kitchen. So what's intuitively feel this is cost, it's not cost effective. Well, later we found out that the cost ratio is completely different. It's something else. You don't have to think about this way, but that's the way people thought about it, and they refused to spend the money. And finally, there was no supportive public opinion, which really perplexed me. Why people are not demanding to be defended? I will skip forward and tell you that my analysis now, perception now is that people didn't believe it is going to work. We all lived through the disappointment of 1991, where the Patriot were deployed to Israel and Saudi Arabia and didn't do much. So that was etched to the public opinion. There was no demand for active defense. But following the 2006 war, 53 Israelis were killed by rockets. 53 Israelis were killed, and just the damage carried by the treasury. By law, the Israel treasury has to cover damage from hostile action. It's the insurance company of the citizen. So they paid 2 billion shekels, half a billion dollars just for damage after the Lebanon war. So Israel MOD overruled the military and twisted down the treasury and went to a crash emergency mode of developing a missile defense, dedicated missile defense system against the rockets. Next slide, please. Next slide. The missile was rushed into action in March last year, rushed into action before being operational, even initial operation capability on an emergency basis. Excuse me. And immediately, a few days later, it went into action. April 1st, 2005, for the first operational success. Everybody was amazed, and my journalist friends called me and said, he had to call probably by error. It was just a chance of luck. No luck. I told you it's going to work. And it worked. It worked in April, then there was another cycle in August, another cycle in October. A very extensive cycle of violence emerged with the government. It became more and more successful. And each cycle of firing, I don't know, people learned how to use it better and better. And then in June, 2 months ago, was another round that was 2 months ago, so I could expect another round to start somewhere, not in the far future. System was very successful. It did two things. First, it successfully discriminated between rockets which are going to hit an open area in the desert and rockets which are going to hit a populated area. That was an idea to do it. Lightning quick. As soon as it comes out, you get discriminated, which to engage and which not to engage. Otherwise, you waste a lot of ammunition. So it was very successful in that, and the rockets that were engaged, the success rate started climbing from 75% to 85%. Now I hear numbers like 90%. So it's very successful in that, to the surprise of everyone except me. Losses and damages, if you just take this as a measure of effectiveness, dramatically reduced. We had one man killed during this year in the defended area. We had more casualties, but in undefended area, you can't defend everywhere. So when we defended, in the defended relation, only one person was killed during this year from 500 rockets. And this is a dramatic, we look the number of the dramatic change. Next slide, please. Do me a favor. Go back, and hyperlink this one. You see some footage, no, not that one, that one. Here is the first interception ever, and this is the only clip the list of us. From that point on, it's only amateurs. I'm taking these pictures, and this is the thing taken out. Footage taken by very patiently waiting for a rocket to get out and then follow the rocket, show the whole sequence. And now this is not a drill, this is not test range. And what's going after is not a dummy target, it's going after a live ground rocket with 15 kilogram warhead, which could hit the city of Ashkelon. And here you see the kill. That's it. And you see the explosion is there. Next. Now, what it's doing, it's not just hitting the other rocket, it's hitting the warhead of the rocket, making it explode. Here is a case of two against one, a little fire. Here is one taken out in the second round, the mate has no target now. So it's turning very sharply and going to what we call the graveyard, the area where you can self-destruct safely. And then you see a bombing of two, one against one. Here is the first one taken out, the second one is too low now. So the round is maneuvering, the round is maneuvering to take it from below. See the background, you can hear the volume of the sound. This is a civilized group of four, out of which three were engaged. One went into the desert, three were engaged. And believe me, this is daytime, so it's hard to see. I counted an explosion under each, three explosions. But we see there's a dead round here of the noise, the people talking excitedly. Very slime, very it's disturbing the birds and the dogs. Come on. Somebody ran out of his house. This is some guy from Ashdod who put his camera and knew where the rockets are coming from, waited for an alarm and activated his video camera. This is the most, this is a very large sample. Most of them are engaged. I was full of iron men, but it was a large. They can fire them very quickly, they can fire quickly. They fire salvos, we sell fire salvos to them. Well-respected mayor, you need for your city a park, a civic center, and another room battle. And then you are a main man. Next slide. On the other side, we found the opposite. Next slide, please. The impact on the other side was very interesting. Until last March, they completely disregarded it. They never know a Palestinian leader mentioned the Israeli defense. We heard them talking among themselves. On the radio, on the phone, cursing the Israeli missile, but the leaders completely disregarded it, ignored it, until last March, and all of a sudden, they came out blaming us for turning Gaza into an experimental field for Iron Dome. So we have to blame for something. We always to blame for something, but all of a sudden, they went to the mode of vilifying Iron Dome. In Gaza itself, we have evidence of sense of dejection, and here, the policy of celebrating victory after every engagement worked against them. Because they celebrated victory when they didn't manage to achieve anything, they still celebrated victory, and this created a sense of dejection and distrust in Gaza against their own leadership. But, by saying that, they didn't become less better men. They didn't lose the determination to fire rockets. There are some people who are expecting that when you have an effective defense in place, it will discourage the other side from aggression. No, it doesn't. On the contrary, It encouraged them to shoot more, to try to break through the system, to develop tactics to break through the system. We see it immediately. Synchronized firing. As you saw the Syrians and the Iranians, they tried it too. Not successfully. As we say, we can fire as fast as they can. So, until now, not successfully. And in the wider of the Sahel zone, we got the greatest compliment from Iran when we heard Iranian defense minister saying, we are developing our missiles to break through Iran. So this was a compliment in a roundabout way. Next slide. Next slide, please. And our future plans. As of June, we had four batteries defending about more than 500,000 people in the south. Two additional batteries are now in operation, will be commissioned early next year. I wish to use the opportunity to thank the United States President, Congress, and people for the generous help to Israel. The support, money, the financial support is now enabling us to manufacture an Iron Dome in full blast now. All our production are working, and there may be parallel production in the United States. An improved version of the interceptor was now being tested and will be shortly deployed. And here you see a picture of your Secretary of Defense and our Minister of Defense visiting the Iron Dome battery in the south of Israel. Next slide. So in conclusion of this chapter of military history, I said we write in the book up to now, three things I say, three lessons. First, we used to say you cannot hit a bullet with a bullet. Now this Grad missile is something about yay thick and about yay high, and it's a stumble bullet in those finance sky. You have to find this needle in the haystack and hit it on the nose. I think people thought it couldn't be done, it can be done. We have coordinated 105 times until now. It can be done with current technologies. A lot of people say that you have to wait for the next generation high power lasers and things like that. No, it can be done with today's technology, and let the future technology nature, their nature and time will give better solution. But right now it can be done and it is done, and cities don't need to be neither Tel Aviv nor Ashdod nor Kabul. It needs to be hostages to any crazy with the rocket. To recognize this achievement, it's quite an achievement of the Israeli Defense Industry, the Israel Air Force. They were honored by the Israel Defense Prize, which will be granted to them, awarded to them by the Israel's president in his mansion next month. And with this, I'd like to conclude this presentation. Next slide, please. Next slide. Just a second.
We have a few minutes, so I will not ask a question, but I will tell you two things. One, we have some of our publications right here. There's a piece by Mike Eisenstadt from the Washington Institute on the strategic culture of the Islamic Republic, one of our short pieces, and one that covers the last 2 years of some of our writings on Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Middle East in general. Also a brochure about what we do. And also, I just wanted to tell you, I think I know who the phone was. It was your wife. Today is Uzi's 52nd anniversary, and he has abandoned his wife in Israel and been here. So he's calling and saying, you know, why he's not calling back. But further ado, please introduce yourself, and we have about 20 minutes for Q&A, please. Yes, please.
Sir, Lieutenant Commander Simon, U.S. Navy. How would you suggest that we interpret recent communications from the Netanyahu government, the replacement of the Homeland Minister with Avi Dichter, the continued suggestion of unilateral attack being a possibility against Iran? How do you reconcile that? How should we reconcile that with the vulnerability of Israel's core to 13,000 rockets and missiles from the radical alignment?
I separate this thing in my mind. I think that people should separate this thing. There is a question of Iran, what to do about Iran. But Iran is not the only source of missile threat on Israel. Again, I don't know what's going to happen in Syria. But until about half a year ago, I would say that I showed you the count of warheads that commit Israel. Most of them originate in Syria, not in Iran. So I think this equation here of Netanyahu's policy and Israeli vulnerability is not the right equation. Israeli vulnerability is an invariable by itself. And Iran is another issue. In any case, without any reason that there will be a conflict, the Israeli vulnerability is there in place. So that's why I wouldn't connect these two things with each other.
Please, Father.
Thank you very much. That was a fascinating presentation. I'm Barbara Slater. I'm from the Atlantic Council and AlMonitor.com, which is a new website on the Middle East. I want to expand a little bit on that question and ask you to make a political judgment, if you would, about the wisdom of Israel starting something with Iran at this time, given the potential retaliation against Israel from all sorts of sources, and whether you think that the Syrians might actually launch some of these missiles against Israel in conjunction with its ally, Iran, to change the subject from what's going on within that country. Thank you.
Well, this is really a question which is, I'm a technical person, not a political one. And that question, if the political wisdom or not wisdom, is not a question of if the threat is tolerable or intolerable, and this is in the observer's mind. Now, that people have their opinion, and in Israel there is an open discussion about that. There is a segment in public opinion which is strongly believes that the threat from Iran doesn't warrant going into war, and there is a section in public opinion that believes the threat is so deadly that it's wants to go into war. Remember Israel, we can give you an example about Israeli reaction to situations. One was the 6 days war when the perception was that if we don't do a reactive attack, with all that entailed, with all that it entailed at the time, and nobody, there was no guarantee of victory. The contrary, let me, I'm not sure the secret that graves were to be prepared for tens of thousands of victims in the Tel Aviv area. But still the decision of the government backed by the people was to go to war because the situation seems like a deadly danger, not just to the existence of the state, but to the physical existence of its people. Then I can give you the opposite example of 6 years later, the young people who in the Israeli government decided not to play, which is a controversial discussion until this very day. But they had conclusion. So really, it's a matter of how you judge the threat. So some people in Israel, say most of the analysts in Israel, judge it not to be deadly and not wanting the attack. And some people believe that this situation is intolerable. And this is open discussion. Excuse me? I don't think it would be appropriate for me to give a view. With your permission, but it's really out of my pay grade.
Please,
Father.
The discussion of the missile threat was obviously the key part of this presentation, and it was fascinating. Thank you very much for what you did. I'd like to go back over to the first part, the very beginning of your presentation, because it's what most people on the battlefield, whether you're talking about Israelis, Americans, the enemy that we face in Iraq, now in Afghanistan and elsewhere, you were quoting Hassan Nasrallah, and one of the key bullets that you took out of his comments or his position is, we embrace the possibility of death. How do you deal with an enemy if your opening position is, guys, I'll put it in the American vernacular, you're obviously familiar with that, guys, knock it off. If you don't stop it, we're going to come after you. If we come after you, we'll take you prisoner, we may take you to a desert island someplace, we may extract information from you, but at worst comes to worst,
will shoot and will shoot to kill. What happens to that deterrent, the threat of killing them, if their reaction is to say, honky, save your ammo, we intend to kill ourselves while we go after you, while we try to kill you? It becomes a kind of a Hobbesian world of kill or be killed, and Israel obviously is facing that threat. How do you deal with an enemy that relishes the prospect of being killed while trying to kill you?
We know the experience that we have, and then this is a situation where Cook is being written, and we kind of follow them. But they have a vulnerability. First, this talk is, you know, like everything in life, it's not entirely true. There's nobody who is not afraid of that. But mainly it depends on who we're talking about. In our experience with the war in Gaza, this conflict in Gaza, is that you go after the leaders. You take out the leadership, this time. And there's a period where you took out the whole leadership of Hamas, one after the other, during a period of about 2 weeks. We know that you put the fear of death on it. It's not just the fear of being killed. It's your humiliation. Your leadership should be taken out. I think that what your country is now doing in Afghanistan is of the same style, going after the key people and eliminating them. We found from experience when we broke up the suicide attack against Israel, if you remember in 2002, 2003, life became intolerable in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Every 2 or 3 days we had a suicide or exploding and killing 30, 40, 50 people. The tactic was to go after the chain and after the local leaders. And the impression was that when we managed to kill about, eliminate about 20% of the leadership, the system falls down on itself. There is some kind of a critical point. You don't have to kill all of them. If you take 2 or 3 of them, it doesn't work. You can't come in. But when you take a certain percentage, which is very elusive, how much it is, the system falls apart. And that will stop them. After a while, in 2004, 2005, things settled up. They ran out of possibilities. And maybe that's a conflict that we clearly want.
Please. Typical inbox of visiting military fellow at the Washington Institute. My question is about deterrence theory in the Gulf right now. We're trying to work with the GCC countries to build a missile defense system, and as we sell them different missile defenses, that Patriot, even a new X-band radar to go with Qatar, we kind of thought that we would deter Iran from more missile building. This would be a deterrent against them to build more missiles and launch more missiles, but it's not done that. Any thoughts on missile defense as a deterrent towards Iran?
No, missile defense is not a deterrent. No, missile defense is not a deterrent. Missile defense in the context of conventional war is not a deterrent. On the contrary, missile defense will energize the other side to do everything in order to overcome it. But missile defense is necessary. I said the three objectives of missile defense in Israel, I think, are two words of the government. The first one is to preserve the capability to wage war. Now, the Persian Gulf countries, the UAE, Kuwait, all have power stations, all have economical target, all of them have sensitive points. If our hit, we stop functioning and we stop supporting the war. We can't fight the war with all this infrastructure being taken out. I'm not talking about it in military stuff. It's very hard to take out an aircraft, an airfield. But in military air base, if you hit the runways, they can be fixed. But if you hit a vulnerable spot in a power station, then it takes months to fix that up. You can't do it on the spot. And let me give you just one example. Water desalination, a place which is dependent on desalination. Take out the water and you stop the capability of fighting war. You need missile defense first as a kind of a cheap passive defense. I think the alternative to that is to cover everything with concrete. Believe me, it's much more expensive. I didn't have time to mention the numbers, but when we went into passive defense in Al-Sar, our government spent up to now 2 billion shekels, $500 million, just to defend the people in this narrow strip of 4 kilometers around the Gaza Strip. $4 billion, $500 million. This is twice as much as it costs us to develop and build the first two batteries of iron dome. Active defense is cheaper than passive defense. The economics are very clear. So theoretically, you build thick concrete shelters above the desalination plant and the electrical power plant. It's cheaper to buy battery. Now, there is a case where missile defense is a deterrent, but it's not the convention. You could argue that in some cases nuclear confrontation, and some people discuss that the other way. I argue that it is a deterrent. But this is a different argument than we have in that situation.
Please.
Thank you. Hi, Eric Marr with Guardian Systems Consulting. Is the current Israeli missile defense system designed with the assumption that there will be a nuclear-armed Iran at some point, or would a nuclear-armed Iran necessitate some transformation in the Israeli program?
Well, that's the way the Israeli missile defense was conceived at the time where we didn't see any nuclear threat, and the main threat to Israel, unconventional threat, came from the Syrian chemical warhead on the Scud missile. It was designed mainly against this threat in mind. Another attribute of missile active defense, missile defense, is that it doesn't go after any particular warhead. It goes against the warhead, whatever it is in it. Believe me, we cannot see what's inside the warhead of a missile coming in. It could be not at all what to say. The missile is designed to hit and destroy that, this missile defense is designed to hit and destroy the missile that we designate as a threat, whether it's nuclear, chemical, or conventional. So if you say Israel missile defense has delivered a nuclear missile, of course it has. Because those nuclear missiles act and behave exactly as non-nuclear missiles. In fact, the threat now is more from conventional ones than nuclear ones, and I believe that Israel has a nuclear arsenal, it will be part of a larger arsenal. Again, don't take the example of the confrontation of the United States and the Soviet Union. We didn't have conventional ICBMs. And the Red Chief Order. Whatever was an ICBM was nuclear. This is not the situation in the Middle East. So if you ask the system of designed against nuclear missiles, no. Designed against the conventional one. But if you defend against them, automatically it defends also against the nuclear one.
Yes, please. That's the last question.
Ryan Carl from the Marine Corps Combat Development Command. What are your capabilities with your system with regards to the emerging UAV threats, and what are your views on the growth of that threat against Israel in the future?
That's the UAV threat, and I didn't catch the second one. You said UAV threat and?
And what are your plans to address the emerging UAV threat in the future?
UAV can be taken out. It's not such a challenging. It's a challenging situation, but just to give an example, in the Lebanon War, one of the subplots of that Second Lebanon War was the fact that we were attacked by armed UAVs, not just for observation. UAV with the warheads were flown into Israel in order probably to reach Tel Aviv, and four of them were launched in the last 2 or 3 days before the end of the war. And the Hezbollah, I think two of them went to Greece for some natural reasons, I don't know why, and two of them were shot down by Israeli F-16s armed with a 5.5 vertical missile. There was a beautiful footage of one of them being shot down, and then it was found, it fell into a shallow sea, and it was taken up. They have nice pictures of these pieces of the Hezbollah UAV. It can be done. Of course, it's very, not cost-effective to do it with F-16. You want to have something better than that. But this is not part of missile defense. You need something special for that. Probably high-energy weapons in the future. Because here you don't need high power. For missile defense, even against rockets, you need a beam of about 100 kilowatts. Just to give you the feeling, the industrial weapons, the industrial lasers that you see cutting metals are 5 kilowatts. Maybe 100 kilowatts is 50 times more. Without that, it's not worth going after missiles and rockets. But against a UAV, 10 kilowatts, which is almost industrial power, is sufficient.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.